It's Light the Tower, your daily look around the world of sports with Hall of Fame broadcaster and voice of the Texas Longhorns, Craig Way.
Say goodnight to this one!
And Horns 24/7 insider, Jeff Howe. On your live, local, and independent home for sports talk in Austin, The Horn.
Second hour of Light the Tower on the Horn. Craig Way. And yes, my co-host is here, fresh from putting the icing on the cake of the latest edition of the Blitz podcast, which you can hear tonight live, 7 o'clock, or you can hear it tonight at 7 o'clock on the Horn. He's the pride of Northwest Williamson County, a proud graduate of Florence High School.
Damn right.
Whose Buffaloes are still in the playoff picture in 13-3A Division II. They need to beat Riesel this week. Then they need Riesel to beat Buffalo next week. That's it. Doesn't matter what they do against Roger. So it's as simple as that. But I digress. You know him best for his outstanding work at Horns 24/7. That would be Jeff Howe.
I still work here, much to the chagrin of some, I'm sure. But
No. I'm glad to have you on board.
Wasn't here for hour number one. Like you said, finishing the blitz. It's football therapy when we record that show.
So how did the therapy session go?
It was good. It was good. A lot of talk. Some of the stuff we're going to talk about right now, actually, and you can hear the blitz 7 o'clock tonight here on the Horn. A lot of Big 12 stuff because, you know, during a bye week, very rarely do I get to watch a little bit of all the Big 12 games, but I did watch a little bit of all the Big 12 games that were on last weekend, including watched a lot of that. It was going back and forth between K-State Tech and OUKU, which didn't think I was going to watch as much of that game as I had to.
It turned out to be.
Such is life. You know, watched a little West Virginia TCU at night. Obviously, was locked in for most of, if not all, of Iowa State and Oklahoma State.
Sure.
But you know, just that coaching carousel, Craig, and now that Matt Wells is out, we'll get to that in a minute, but what is that going to do for the rest of the league, the rest of the country? So it's interesting times in the league right now.
Indeed. All right, so we will get to all of that momentarily. I did want to do a little cleanup from hour number one. The story I had at Inconceivable, Jeff, about a cyclist in Alaska being attacked by a bear. Linda sent me this story. A brown bear just kind of came out of the woods onto the road and started charging at him while he was riding his bike. And he's coming right at it, 10 to 15 feet away from me. What would you do?
After I decided I needed a new pair of shorts?
Yep.
I'd turn around and go the other way?
Yeah. What happened was the bear attacked. He got off the bike, kind of shoved it at him. He started yelling at the bear. The bear then kind of went at him, and the man kicked the bear. So he took one bite out of his leg, and then he left. And they say because he kicked that bear in the face, that might have warded him off.
I would not advise that to be a good good strategy, turn a bear encounter to kick a bear in the face.
Yeah, so you had that, and I said, and then he called a friend for help on his cell phone, which was a good thing that he had cell service, as opposed to the other guy who had cell service trying to climb Pikes Peak and was up there in the mountains, got lost and had cell service, but remained lost for over 24 hours because he wouldn't answer his phone because he didn't recognize the number.
Serious?
Yeah, search and rescue people, searching
Man.
For him. Snoop said he might answer it if it was the fourth time calling.
Yeah.
I said, dude, if you're lost in the mountains,
I don't care
you
who
take
it
any
is.
Call.
Yeah. Jeez, man.
It's somebody from BetUS trying to get me to buy a new subscription to gamble.
get me a helicopter and get me out of here and we'll talk.
No, only when you hear those Rod Babers ads, Snoop. It's only this. If they played a recording of Rod doing the ad, that would get you hook, line, and sinker.
Yeah.
Somebody said, sounds like that bear was from Chicago. How'd you got there? Somebody said, don't poke the bear, kick him.
Yeah, the Pikes Peak thing, like, look, death is tragic, but there's just some people that you're like, dude, how'd you make it that far in life?
Yeah.
To get to that point. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know if I'm lost.
And then if he had cell service, why would you not call 911?
Exactly.
We had a couple of auction things come up. Michael Jordan game-worn shoes from rookie season.
What'd those go for?
$1.47 million.
Okay, that makes sense.
One of his earliest games. So CB reminds us it was 37 years ago today he made his NBA debut. So you had that.
Don't overuse the term GOAT. All right, we overuse that. We use it liberally in our talk today. For that guy, it applies.
Yeah, and it also applies to Tom Brady, who we updated the story to say that in addition to, remember Brady said in the postgame news conference, we have to give that guy maybe a couple of jerseys or something. He got two Tom Brady jerseys. He got a Tom Brady helmet.
I mean, game-worn Tom Brady jersey, probably go $40,000-$50,000 probably, yeah, somewhere in that neighborhood.
So he got
maybe
two
more
of those. Okay. He got a Tom Brady autograph helmet.
Yep.
He got
that's a game-worn helmet. That's probably another $40,000-$50,000 somewhere in that neighborhood.
He got a Mike Evans game-worn jersey.
Yeah, okay.
Game cleats from that. $1,000 in the Bucks gear shop.
Team store, yeah.
Team store.
Yeah, that's
$1,000 worth of that. Season tickets to the rest of this year and all of next year.
Still not going to be close to that $500,000 he could have got for the ball.
And then Tom Brady threw in a Bitcoin valued at $63,000.
Okay, cool. Well, good on Tom Brady for making it right then.
Yeah.
I didn't know about the Bitcoin thing. I knew about everything.
He said that when he was on with Eli and Peyton last night on Monday Night Football. He said, we'll get him. He goes, the guy's name is Byron Kennedy. He said, unfortunately, Byron lost all his leverage when he gave up the football. He said, we're going to give him a Bitcoin. So I think he's going to make out pretty good.
Yeah. You know, I saw an interview that guy did with Andrew Siciliano on the NFL Network yesterday.
Yeah.
And they're asking, Siciliano asked him, he said, look, Byron, this is your chance to, are you good with the deal or do you want anything else? The only thing, only other thing the guy asked for, he said, I want a round of golf with Tom Brady, if that's possible. And then he was like, really? That's
all I need.
That's all you want? I was like, yeah. But I guess Tom decided, look, I'm not playing golf with you. Here's a Bitcoin.
Yeah. $63,000 Bitcoin is my time is worth more to me than that. I'll give you the Bitcoin.
Snoopy.
Stoner says, don't sell the Bitcoin.
Hold on. How heavily or closely do you follow the crypto market?
He's into it.
Just in the last week and a half since I quit gambling.
Okay. Just in the last week and a half. So I don't know. Like I know I'm under the impression that Bitcoin is pretty volatile. So I don't know.
It is volatile.
I don't know if 63 G's is a good spot to sell or hold or what. So I don't know.
I'm researching it right now.
Oh, are you now?
I Google what is the upside, but the other one, I don't want to. This is non-sports. But
Stoner says, do not sell that Bitcoin. No. Trust me.
So how high can it go?
Snoop, this third is one show. This show is one third yours. So whatever you got, go ahead and get it out on the table.
No. I haven't read it. I'm just Googling. I haven't got info.
Local Longhorn Lyft driver says, don't poke the bear. Kick him. Make sure you do that.
That's your homework for tomorrow, Snoop. Instead of a Longhorn notebook, I'm going to take out a Longhorn notebook, and I want everything that you know about cryptocurrency.
Jeez.
Okay?
Somebody else wanting to know, I wonder how much the first sandals Jesus were worth. Would they go at auction there at Sotheby's?
Michael Jordan's rookie game used shoes pretty close.
Here's a valid, legitimate question. Why didn't the search and rescue folks not text him? Yeah, text and say, hey, this is search and rescue.
Well, there's a lot of...
That's a good idea. Text.
Yeah. So anyway, there's a lot of
common sense lacking in that story.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah. So there you go. Somebody says, "How come I can't hear the game on Saturday's Horn app?" You can. You have to be redirected off of it to TexasSports.com.
Just gotta navigate your way through the Horn app. You can get there.
You can get there from the Horn app. So there's that. All right. With all of that, it's time for our sharp review of the Big 12. It's brought to you by Sharp Vision Modern LASIK, where believing is seeing. Let me jump right into Oklahoma and Kansas and get your thoughts on this, Jeff, because we have a lot of people weighing in with their opinions on the whole Caleb Williams, Kennedy Brooks, 4th-and-1 situation. What was called on the field was, obviously, as Brooks was being slowed up, Williams takes the ball out of his hands, goes forward, picks up the first down. They reviewed to see if Brooks had crossed the line of scrimmage or if the handoff, as it were, took place beyond the line of scrimmage. It did not. Replay reviewed that. the debate that has come up, there's several prongs of this debate, but some folks have said that the way the rule is written, they heard Trey talking about it yesterday, that it has to be a clear handoff, therefore it should be ruled a fumble. My response to that is it can't be ruled a fumble because, A, it's behind the line of scrimmage, B, it never pops out of their hands. It's no different than a zone read where one guy's pulling it out of the other guy's hands. Mm-hmm. It's no different than that. That's one thing. The larger argument, and it's a valid point, as to whether the whistle should have been blown, forward progress stopped. I agree you could make that definite argument.
I think his forward progress was stopped.
Yep. Unfortunately, but, it's not reviewable.
And the whistle never blew, like you said, it's not reviewable. No, my interpretation of the rule, the way I read the rule was, Kennedy Brooks, since he's in possession of the ball, to be considered across the line of scrimmage, his body has to be beyond the line of scrimmage. It wasn't, therefore, it's still behind the line of scrimmage. So like you said, Craig, that's a convoluted way to look at it, but it really is. It's like no different than like a handing it off at the mesh point at the start of a play.
Yep.
Because the ball carrier was never across the line of scrimmage.
Yeah. So hopefully that settles debate. So there's that. Meanwhile, on the field, Oklahoma, who would have seen them struggling with Kansas?
Look, Kevin Flaherty, who covers national college basketball for us at 24/7 Sports, Kevin's a KU grad. He and I have said this for years. Kansas has the most underrated home field advantage in the country when they play an 11 a.m. home game. Because typically in a conference game, it's usually, you know, late September, early October or later. At 11 a.m., there's no juice in the stadium because the stadium is a quarter full.
I've seen that several times when Texas has played there.
It's really hard for an opponent to get up for that. And if you're Kansas, you've typically got nothing to lose in those situations. So, really, it is, in a weird way, the most underrated home field advantage you could have. Because look at KU's success. There's been a couple times where Kansas has almost beaten Texas in some of those 11 a.m. games.
Yep. Yep.
With no crowd.
The one
no
they beat
juice.
Texas was a 230 kick.
Right. No crowd, no juice, all the above. So, yeah, it's just one of those deals. That's why typically you'll look up and somebody's going to lose a game in Lawrence once a year. I don't think this is going to be that year, but it was close. There was, like I said yesterday, there was a brief second where I thought maybe, perhaps, my stone cold lead pipe lock of the season of the century in the Big 12 for Kansas to be over 1.5 wins. There's a split second in the second half. I was like, okay.
Could this be happening?
Is this really going to be it? But alas, no. It was not meant to be.
All right. The other Kansas team won.
Hell of an effort by the Jayhawks, though.
It was. The other Kansas team, Kansas State, won its game. Deuce Vaughn, 3 touchdowns, the former Cedar Ridge Raider. And it wound up costing Matt. Well, or let's just say it was the final straw in Texas Tech's decision to dismiss Matt Wells.
They were rolling. Now look up, it's like 14-3. I'm like, yeah, the Red Raiders haven't figured out.
They had a 24-10 halftime lead,
yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. They were rolling. And then early in that second half, K-State gets a safety, and it was all downhill from there. K-State had all the momentum. Skylar Thompson started figuring some things out. Deuce Vaughn, a big day for him. And, you know, if you go back to when Matt Wells was hired, he was at best their second choice. They wanted Dana Holgorsen. It didn't work out, but you know, it never seemed like it really fit. And like you look at like when Matt Rhule took the Baylor job, a guy coming from outside the state, coming into an in-state school, Matt Rhule did everything. On top of the fact that Matt Rhule might be the best talent evaluator in football at any level,
right?
Matt Rhule did exactly what he needed to do. He went and hired David Wetzel on his staff. He hired Joey McGuire on his staff. He brought Sean Bell back into the program. Mm-hmm. Guys that had ties to Baylor, guys that had ties to the Texas High School Coach Association. Matt Rhule made all the right moves, and Matt Wells really didn't do any of that. And it never really seemed to click.
By the way, it's not helping Matt Rhule with Carolina right now. He got beat 25-3 by the Giants.
And that old quarterback situation's a little bit pesky right now.
Yeah, that's kind of difficult for them there. But your point is well made. Okay, so then there's two other games. TCU and West Virginia I don't know as I'd go as far as to say that West Virginia looked more like the team you and I and others thought might be at there. But TCU continues to not look like the heavily competitive team.
And I'll tell you this, Craig, just getting the pulse of that situation in Fort Worth. It's a lot of similarities between TCU right now and Texas in 2012, 2013. Like, I think from the outside you see the end, but it's kind of similar dynamics. You've got old money in Fort Worth and at that time of that TCU program. Well, they're 100% behind Gary Patterson because they remember what it was like before he really got that thing rolling.
Mm-hmm.
But now you've got young money and you got a new generation of TCU grads that have money. And all they've known is top 10, top 5 finishes, double-digit wins, going to New Year's Six Bowls, winning conference championships. And that hasn't happened right now. And even starting to see comments on TCU message boards. You know, Jeremy Clark does a really good job with Horned Frog Blitz, our 24/7 sports TCU property. Look at their message board. You know, after the game, Gary Patterson referenced, yeah, I mean, 2004 we were 5-6, and the next year, you know, we beat Oklahoma, we go 11-1. And the common response is, yeah, you've had 2004 for about 4 years in a row now. So there's a good chunk of that fan base that feels like they're ready to move on. That's going to get ugly. It's going to get ugly before it gets prettier because they're just not playing good football right now.
Mm. And, you know, was it more about them not playing good football than it was about West Virginia stepping up and playing well?
For sure. Craig, come on.
Yeah. Well, this, I mean, you know, you'd had some hope about
when has a fan base after a loss ever said, you know what, we just got our tail kicked by a better team that day. Yeah. Very rarely does that happen.
Yeah. Yeah,
especially considering the expectations, me included, I had for TCU going into the year. I felt like they were going to be in the mix, and they're
true. But you also had expectations for West Virginia.
Yeah, I love me some Neil Brown. I figured, hey, defensively, they can play with anybody in the league. It's just, can they find enough offense? If a team focuses on shutting down Letty Brown or Letty Brown has an off night, where are they going to find offense from? That's been a challenge for them.
Yeah, yeah. And then the highlight game was Iowa State, Oklahoma State, and it lived up to the billing. It was a very entertaining game.
Has that officiating crew been disciplined?
That's the same crew, I think, that's worked a couple of other Texas games that I know the coaching staff wasn't pleased with. Let me
say this. Blaming the officials for the outcome of a game, it is a lazy argument.
Yeah.
Because you can point to other instances in a game, especially a one-possession game, where the team had an opportunity to control their own destiny and should have and didn't take care of their business. You had an opportunity to not put the game in an official's hands.
Yep.
Okay? So I hate blaming the refs. It's a weak, tired, lazy argument. That said, the call on the Xavier Hutchinson on sportsmanlike conduct, that is the worst dog crap call I have ever seen in my life on a football field. And I was there for the Puna Ford defensive holding on a run.
I was going to say, it's worse than that.
It is the most.
It's worse than the flagging Charlie Strong when the bump coming up the sidelines. It's worse than that even.
It's the Miami Phantom pass interference call in the national championship game with Ohio State, which, by the way, was also a Big 12 crew.
Yeah.
It's the worst call I've seen. Officials need. And look, I understand, like, Tasso here in the state of Texas, there's an official shortage, and that's a job that nobody wants.
Yeah.
Right? It's a tough gig. One thing, I've said this for years, Craig, Power 5 leagues should be in a point where you can have full-time officials. You should be able to pay officials to be full-time officials.
Yep.
You're that critical of a position in the sport when we're talking about Power 5 football. But officials, nobody buys a ticket. Nobody tunes in to see you do your job. You're there to make sure everything stays in line. You're no different than a writer. My job as a writer, I'm supposed to tell the story. I'm not supposed to be a part of the story.
I totally agree. Same here.
You're supposed to monitor the game, not be a part of it.
Yep.
That call was nothing more than a referee on a power trip. It was ludicrous. It was bogus. It was garbage. And it should never happen again. And if the Big 12 had any guts, if Bob Bowlesby stopped taking time to take pot shots at Oklahoma and Texas on their way out of the league and actually had a spine and wanted to discipline his head of officials for not disciplining his crews, something needs to happen in this league to stop the garbage officiating in this conference.
Yeah.
It's normally bad. There is no defense for what was called. Thank goodness Iowa State ends up scoring on that possession.
Three plays later. Otherwise, Hutchinson again.
Otherwise, that's all we're talking about.
Yeah.
We're not talking about Oklahoma State going on the road as an underdog winning a game. That's all we're talking about is that call.
Yeah.
It was god-awful.
Yeah.
And somebody needs to be disciplined for it.
So, fortunately for Iowa State, it turned out that. And I will say this now, for those of you, we had a question on the Specs text line last week asking me to break down permutations of how could Texas still get the Big 12 championship game. And I'm like, whoa. I mean, it's a pretty remote chance right now. Well, one little chip that needed to fall in the direction of Texas, for those of you who are keeping hope alive about it, did fall that way. You needed Oklahoma State to lose. Now, they got to lose again, and they got to lose a game that nobody would. Iowa State was favored in the game. So, I think a lot of folks are not surprised that Iowa State won the game.
Texas has to win out. Oak State has to lose two more games.
Yeah, and if you are to assume that Oklahoma will beat them, which is not necessarily a safe assumption, the game is in Stillwater, and we've seen how Oklahoma has been playing. But even if you are to count that in, in addition to that, Texas has to win out, like you said. Baylor would have to lose another game, probably to Oklahoma, and Iowa State would have to lose
Texas,
a game.
Baylor already has one conference loss, and Texas would have a head-to-head tiebreaker.
If you had the head-to-head tiebreaker, I'm talking about in the safest thing to avoid a multiple-time tiebreaker where rankings might factor into it and keep them out of it. So if you were to assume that Oklahoma, and like I said, it's anything but a safe assumption, but if you were to assume that Oklahoma will run the table and beat Baylor in Waco, by the way, and beat Oklahoma State in Stillwater, by the way, and beat Iowa State, that game's at home. If they were to win those games, Texas wins out, and you need Oklahoma State to lose one more time. That's the path, if you're interested in learning about the path. We were asked, there's the answer.
Well, here's the bottom line. Texas doesn't win on Saturday in Waco, none of it matters.
None of it. Zero of it matters. And we're going to get to that coming up next with the Longhorn Notebook as we continue with Light the Tower. On the Horn, 104.9, 101.9, AM 1260. We're live, local, and digital on the Horn app and at hornfm.com. This is Light the Tower on the Horn. I didn't get to see Billy Joel out at Coda on Saturday, but I heard it was outstanding. But then again, I saw him at Fenway Park in August when he was back on tour, and it was an outstanding show, and I'm sure it was as well there. And we continue with the discussion. DC Horn with a couple of texts here on our specs. He said, Texas won't win out. Baylor and Iowa State will get them. They might. They might, and I didn't say they were. We were asked the question about how could they have a path to the Big 12 championship with this. Somebody texted in that question, so I was laying it out how it would happen. And then DC Horn says Texas versus UTSA in the Alamo Bowl. I can promise you that won't happen. The
Alamo Bowl has a Pac-12 tie-in.
It's Pac-12. So. It's not Conference USA does not have a tie-in with that. Was it Jerry Palm had a projection at Texas in the Alamo Bowl against
Arizona State, I think.
Yeah.
Sounds right.
I think it's Arizona State.
We can just not do the Alamo Bowl again, please. I'd like to go to a postseason game that's more than an hour beyond my front door.
Okay, so you'd be good with the Cheez-It Bowl in Orlando.
Fine.
Which would be the next in the pecking order.
I think the Cheez-It Bowl gets knocked because of the name, but that's the old Camping World Bowl.
Yeah.
That's the big...
The old Tangerine Bowl.
The Big 12 number three against the ACC number three or four, whatever. Notre Dame can run in there every like two or three years or whatever.
Yeah, the projections I've seen about that say it would be Texas against... Are you ready for it? North Carolina.
See, I saw one that had Texas and NC State.
I did too.
So
I did. So it could be either one of those if it were to happen. But anyway, that's on down the road, and Texas is still two wins away from bowl eligibility. Anyway, toward that end, it's time now for the notebook.
Jeff Howe's Longhorn Notebook.
You know, anytime we kind of get to Tuesday, I like to do a first look at a program, and typically I like to give a history lesson. Well, Baylor's is fascinating if you look at Baylor's history as a Big 12 program. Now, this is a program that under Grant Taff got to respectability in the Southwest Conference.
I mean,
Baylor was one of those games that, you know, you couldn't just show up and expect to win it. I mean, and Grant Taff had, over the years, there were every 3 or 4 years would have a really good team that was capable of competing for a conference championship. Mm-hmm. But when Baylor got into the Big 12, and we don't have enough time in the rest of our shows for the rest of the year to go into the history lesson of how Baylor got into the Big 12, but they did nonetheless. 1996 was Baylor's first year in the Big 12, and they get into the Big 12 with Chuck Reedy. And Craig, I don't know if you've ever flipped through a Phil Steele magazine front to back and really read that thing. But Phil Steele, I don't know if he still does, but there was a while where he had a term called getting Baylored.
Yeah.
And basically where he came up with the term of getting Baylored was exactly what happened with Chuck Reedy. Chuck Reedy had one losing season in 1996, Baylor's first year in the Big 12. They go 4-7 overall. They're 1-7 in conference play. And Baylor fires Chuck Reedy. And Phil Steele used that term to look at just how fast Baylor went from being a pretty respectable middle-of-the-road program to just absolute garbage in a matter of time. If you go, Craig, from Baylor's history as a Big 12 program, from 1996 through 2009, so this goes from Chuck Reedy's final season through year two of Art Briles. Now, keep in mind, year two for Art Briles, Robert Griffin got hurt early in that year, which just completely derailed any hopes Baylor had of breaking a bowl drought. At that point, Baylor's last bowl game was the 1994 Alamo Bowl. Mm-hmm. They were in the Southwest Conference. Baylor had yet to make a bowl game as a Big 12 team. You ready for Baylor's record in those 14 seasons, Craig? How about 43-117 overall?
I witnessed a lot of that.
So did I, because I was covering Baylor during the Guy Morris era. 43-117 overall, 14-102 in conference play. They had a string under Kevin Steele where they had three straight winless seasons in conference. Kevin Steele was there from 1999 to 2002. They were 1-31 in Big 12 play. You can make an argument that at the time Guy Morris took the job in 2003, he was taking over the worst power conference program in America.
Yeah, it could have been. By the way, I thought about Kevin Steele last night.
Well, I'm interested to hear how this segue's going.
Well, you'll be able to follow. I was watching the Monday Night Football game. So it's Saints Seahawks. The Saints get the stop almost with that pick six there, which, by the way, probably made Mark Honig's heart come out of his throat, because if it had been a pick six, he would have won his fantasy game. He did not.
Dang.
He lost by 2 points. But anyway, the Saints took over there down around the 10-yard line, and they could have just run it in for an oh-by-the-way touchdown, or maybe, you never know, you might need the points plus tiebreaker thing. So you know where I'm going with this.
Oh, yeah. Game one for Kevin Steele.
Game number one for Kevin Steele. Baylor is about to beat UNLV, and they decide to punch it in. What do you say? Make a statement, I guess it was.
Boy, they made a statement.
Fumbled, returned 96 yards, I think it was, for a walk-off touchdown for UNLV against Baylor.
They were bad. But we talked about this on the Blitz just in terms of, look, for so long, Baylor just made two really bad hires with Dave Roberts and Kevin Steele. And you can argue Kevin Steele might – boy, this is covering a lot of ground. Charlie Weiss is in this mix. Turner Gill's in this mix. You have to put John Blake in there. In the history of the Big 12, Kevin Steele might be the worst hire any program has ever made.
Whoa, that's going somewhere.
That's 9-36 and 1-31 in conference play over 4 years. Like I just said, covers a lot of ground.
Yeah.
It's debatable. We don't have time to debate it today, that's how bad Baylor was. But, you know, I remember when Baylor hired Guy Morris. Mm-hmm. And at the time, Kentucky, Hal Mumme was the head coach of Kentucky, and they had gotten themselves in trouble. There was some probation coming. And Guy Morris had that season in 02 at Kentucky where they went 7-5.
Would have been eight and four
had it not been for that whole LSU fiasco.
Devery Henderson, students running onto the field, they're dumping the Gatorade bucket.
Guy Moore's got the Gatorade bath and everything. And
while
then,
the game-winning play was happening for
Marcus
LSU.
Ran. By the way, had that game gone the other way, Rod Baber's last win as the Texas Longhorn in the Cotton Bowl might have been over a Guy Moore's coached Kentucky team rather than a Nick Saban coached LSU team in the Cotton Bowl that year.
Yeah.
But I digress. But I remember at the time, like, wow, Baylor hires Guy Morris away from Kentucky. That's a really good hire. And you look at Guy Morris's tenure, Craig, over five seasons, he's 18-40, he's 7-33 in Big 12 play. But here's where the fortune starts getting reversed for Baylor. When we talk about head coaching hires, we don't talk enough about timing. Timing can be good, timing can be bad. Charlie Strong timing, bad. Takes over the Texas program, mm-hmm. probably the time where you don't want to take it over. Plus, there was that whole Nick Saban fiasco that we don't have time to get into on this show right now. But the timing was just bad. But the timing was really good for Baylor. So Guy Morris takes over the program and turns over the program when he gets fired in 07. That roster is in a much better place than it was when he took the job. That program is in a much better place than it was when he took the job. And right about that time, you've got Art Briles at U of H. Look, say whatever you want about Art Briles as a human being, and I'll agree with you. But we're just talking about in the context of football. Okay, that's where we'll keep this debate, this discussion right now. Art Briles is at Houston, and had probably done everything he could at Houston at that point. You hit a ceiling, you weren't going to go any higher. So Art Briles is ready to take that next step. Baylor's moving on from Guy Morris. Boom, you make the hire. But while Art Briles had been perfecting the veer and shoot at the college level, he also had a really important piece in that recruiting class at Houston. He had Robert Griffin committed at Houston.
Who was going to run track there. That was part
right. And while other schools, they saw him as just a track guy or a wide receiver or a defensive back. No, Art Briles decided, I'm going to make this guy quarterback.
By the way, he can run this offense. One of the tragic turning points for Texas toward that end, Larry McDuff telling Mack Brown that RG3 was only a track guy. And we don't need, his job was to recruit Central Texas and failed miserably at it.
The one year he was at Texas.
And
just so happened you had a guy that was a transcendent type guy at quarterback position. But so I mentioned those numbers from Chuck Reedy's final year to year two through year two under Art Briles, where Robert Griffin got hurt with a knee injury early in the year. Baylor 43-117 over 14 seasons. Under Art Briles from 2010 to 2015, Baylor breaks their bowl drought in 10. They go 57-23 overall. They're 36-17 in conference play. They win two conference championships. And what's remarkable about Baylor is not only did they recover from Kevin Steele making Baylor arguably the worst power conference program in the country, they somehow, because they hire the right guy, survive all the fallout from Art Briles. Because keep in mind, between Art Briles and Matt Rhule, there was that one year under Jim Grober. They were just kind of hanging on and just got through the year. They were 7-6 and actually ended up winning a bowl game. And then Matt Rhule comes in, and you have a complete culture change. And he goes 1-11 that first year, but they're 7-6 the following year. Then they are in overtime against Oklahoma with a playoff berth, a CFP berth on the line. Matt Rhule leaves, and then Dave Aranda, the way it's worked out for Dave Aranda, and you look at where Baylor is this year, Craig, what's remarkable for him is you talk about timing, you think, okay, initially the timing was bad, right? A first-year head coach taking over a program in the middle of a pandemic, it's awful. The good thing for him, though, is because of the COVID eligibility situation, he basically gets year one as a mulligan, gets to redo his coaching, his one mess up on the coaching staff, which he hired Larry Fedora and Joe Wickline to be his OC and his O-line coach, brings in Jeff Grimes from BYU. Now he's got one of the more experienced rosters in the country because of COVID eligibility, and you've managed to pair an offensive coordinator. He found a quarterback that can work with what they've done with Gary Bohannon. Now you've got Baylor losing Matt Rhule, which for most programs that would be a monumental setback. Now you sit here midway point of the season, they're very much in the mix for the Big 12 title.
Absolutely. He's done a tremendous job there.
So it just goes to show you how, this is Texas fans, why you should have hope. Texas Tech fans, why you should have hope. You can run through a cycle where you make just some god-awful hires. All it takes is one or two of the right hires to get you right back into that mix.
True enough. It's D.C. Horn again. Said no way. Schnellenberger. Well, a couple things. First of all, Schnellenberger only coached 1 year at Oklahoma.
Right.
And that was not the Big 12.
Right.
That was still when they were in the Big 8. 95, they went 5-5-1. So I don't think that's the worst hire.
No.
Now, was it bad for Oklahoma? Yeah, but not worst hire in the Big 12. And again, it was pre-Big 12 anyway when you compared those other seasons. They went 5-7-1.
I think a lot of Oklahoma fans, they'll forgive Howard Schnellenberger considering what they got the next 3 years with John Blake.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, John Blake far worse than Howard Schnellenberger.
Talk about bad Big 12 era hires. Charlie Strong's up there because of the win-loss record.
Yep.
You got some Kansas hires in there. Ron Prince would be a candidate.
Yeah.
Even though Ron Prince.
He could be Texas.
He could be Texas. It's about all he did. But.
Yeah. Yeah. There were some not good ones there. All right, we'll be back to wrap up today's edition of Light the Tower on the Wall. So we're done for today, and our thanks again to Hank Carter, head coach of Lake Travis Cavaliers, for joining us. Tomorrow, John Morris, play-by-play voice of the Baylor Bears, will be a little more of a Baylor breakdown.
Love
for us
Mr.
there.
John Morris.
J-Mo will be with us tomorrow. Of course, Wednesday, Todd Dodge, head coach of the Westlake Chaparrals, will join us as well. So look for Snoop, you going to be ready to top five players to watch this week?
Always one of my favorite things to do all week.
All right. So we've got all that and much more to look forward to tomorrow. We thank you for joining us.
I think Snoop's going to kill the Whataburger top five tomorrow. Not like in a bad way. I mean in a good way.
He invariably does. Stay tuned now.
Are you saying he's going to kill it one way or the other?
There you go. Shirts and Skins with Chad and Trey are up next. For Snoop Daniel behind
Snoop.
The glass.
And
for my co-host Jeff Howell. Lots of love going on here. I'm Craig Way. Thanks for joining us. We'll visit with you tomorrow on Light the Tower.